Just a few hours ago, the U.S. Senate confirmed Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court. And I proudly signed the judge's commission aboard Air Force One just before landing.
It's all over, but for the cheering and the booing and the dunking and the protests and the midterms and the Taylor Swifts and the Kanyes. Hello, everyone. Happy Columbus Day. I am Matt Welch, and you're listening to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I wish I could report to you that this will be the last of our, I think, six consecutive weeks talking about the single most controversial Supreme Court confirmation process since back when Catherine Mangan Ward and Peter Sudeman were wearing short pants. But I think we all know the world that we are living in forever and ever. LOL, eat at Arby's. Hello, everyone, and also to Nick Gillespie.
Happy Monday.
Hello.
that's the correct response. We are in a real Republicans are from Mars, Democrats are from Pluto, if that really is a planet, type of a moment. So I wanted to kind of like bite off a little bit on the things that people have been chewing since this 50-48 vote came in. And Peter, I wanted to kind of start with you as our resident norms lamenter. Here, because it seems to me there's been an entire category of response from Democrats, which has been along the lines of, well, look, these are Republican presidents who didn't win the popular vote. They are nominating all these Supreme Court justices. Therefore, these nominations are illegitimate. And by the way, maybe we should have extra Supreme Court seats now and maybe redo the way that the Senate gets elected and make Guam.
You got to get rid of that electoral college.
Get Guam some statehood here. Shouldn't the team norms protectors not rip up the entire system of government here as a response to not getting
You
their
might
way
think
on a nomination?
That, but in fact, what I think we're going to see Democrats do is start to see in some ways a little bit of what we've seen from Republicans over the past 10 years or so, especially post George W. Bush, where Republicans kind of took this attitude that, you know what, we lose too much. We don't win the way we want to. So who cares about decorum? Who cares about process? Who cares about policy at all? Let's just do what we need to do tactically to win. And I think Democrats are going to look at that and think, you know what? Republicans are winning. I don't like that. We don't like that. So let's figure out some norms violations of our own, because everyone here is clearly fighting dirty pool. And why should we tie one hand behind our back? So Michael Avenatti, among others, who is Stormy Daniels' lawyer, also the lawyer for Julie Swetnick, who was the third accuser, who produced a signed document under penalty of perjury, saying that she was aware of Brett Kavanaugh facilitating, not necessarily engaging in, but facilitating gang rapes at parties in his youth. The least believable, I think it's fair to say, of the accusations against him. Avenatti looks like he's going to be a 2020 contender. So one, that tells you something about the direction that the Democrats are going, which is that a figure like Michael Avenatti, a kind of unserious, sort of ridiculous hype monger along the lines, to some extent, of Donald Trump, but for the left. Avenatti has already raised the possibility of court packing. I'm already seeing court packing being discussed on lefty Twitter pretty seriously, and this idea being raised. And I think that that sort of tactical hardball is something that Democrats are really going to be talking up and really going to be, especially sort of the progressive base. They're really going to say, look, this is what Republicans do. We would be tying a hand behind our back. We would be fighting. Why should we fight by the old rules when Republicans clearly don't care about them at all? And so there's going to be a Hatfields and McCoys situation here sort of in terms of process, and it's going to break down, and I think it's going to be pretty ugly.
Nick, Peter referenced Michael Avenatti. Robbie Suave posted a piece on Friday, I believe it was, saying basically, congrats, Michael Avenatti, for delivering this nomination. Susan Collins, who was sort of the swing voter, at least the most dramatic speech in the process. She also referenced the ridiculousness of his kind of late entrance into this as part of her reasoning for it. Doesn't that kind of, isn't that a cop out a little bit too, though? I mean, isn't it sort of not straw man isn't the right word, but doesn't it rob one of agency to make a vote by saying I'm going against the most ridiculous things on the other side rather than take more seriously either the underlying charge or the kind of judicial temperament question of Kavanaugh and the way that he responded in the hearings?
I think that Susan Collins' speech was actually pretty interesting and pretty substantive. So I actually appreciated the fact that she really laid out her argument for why she was making the decision she was making. And of course, I think everybody on this podcast is a fan of Justin Amash, the congressman from Michigan's dedication to doing that for every vote that he makes on his Facebook page. And he's even, I think, to some of us complained about, like, you know, he didn't really know what he was signing up for when he agreed to do that, but it's the right thing to do. I think Susan Collins laid out a lot of stuff. And I do think that part of, you know, part of the problem with all of this, and it's to the extent that we're talking about things like procedure and process, which oftentimes gets skipped over in political discussions because what we really want are is this outcome or that outcome. I think what Collins was responding to was the fact that the process was fucked up, and it was fucked up exactly or only because of Dianne Feinstein, who had information that she held until the last minute and then either leaked or had her staff leak or somebody on her staff leak, so that you don't just get into a real discussion of what's going on and what's at stake, but it all gets squeezed into a moment at the very end of a process, which already had been taking kind of a long time. So without getting into any of the specifics of stuff, I think Collins is right to be like, this all had a sense, and it may not be wrong, but it all had a sense of, we're waiting until the end of the minute, and we're going to throw all the shit that we have against the wall and see what sticks. And that if you're not inclined to think about a senatorial process or political process that way, the more that gets thrown in at the end, it only makes it harder for you to take the whole thing kind of in a slow and judicious
Catherine,
pace.
A lot of the category of response that I have seen to an alarming, even to me degree, someone who has an I voted sticker on my wallet at all times is from Democrats is, okay, the one thing that we take away from all this is that you just got to vote. Got to vote, vote, vote. If we do anything on November 6th, it's that we're just going to vote. And this is how we change things, is that we vote. And also, if we have more people vote, we vote. Can you explain in a spirit of generosity, not in purple-haired snark, Catherine, how there might be other ways to influence political processes besides going to your local?
So I'm actually going to take the surprising, there's going to be a twist here, which is that I actually think in some ways this probably is the most useful response in this narrow moment. That is to say, if the alternative to voting is, or if the thing that people are talking about instead of voting is what happened after Trump was elected, then that stuff will be perhaps even more pointless than voting. And I say that as someone who believes that voting is almost completely pointless. So basically, midterms typically have pretty low turnout. This is sort of a known fact. It is true that, an aggressive turnout effort in midterms might swing a seat or two. But I think, the idea that your vote in a midterm election for a random Democrat who happens to be running in your state has almost anything to do with the broader political tenor or even really with Supreme Court appointments is, as always, a failed, set of logical steps. The alternative, though, is that people start doing this thing where they like get together in their local church and like form the hashtag resistance and come up with ways to like get celebrities to make ads where they speak sincerely into the camera. All of that actually is probably a little bit better for the individual in terms of engaging in the process. But it is, I think, going to take us down this road that we've been talking about of increasingly radical schemes, right? Court packing and sort of full-time protest and that kind of thing, which is not actually going to be to the good. I've been reading about court packing lately, obviously. I think a lot of people have. And it's another great reminder that, like, as bad as our politics seem right now, it is not unprecedentedly bad. Like, politics has been much, much worse than it is today. The court packing era, like, that is a great example of a very, very contentious, dark time in American politics. I don't think we should try to get back there, but I also don't think we're anywhere near there right now.
It's also worth remembering, since I placed some of the burden on Republican tactical warfare here, that Harry Reid, the Democratic Senate Majority Leader, was the one who nuked the filibuster for judicial nominees. And that McConnell, the whole time Harry Reid was warning, was preparing to do this, Mitch McConnell was standing there saying, "You will regret this. You will regret this. You will regret this."
And here he is.
If you put two guns out on the table, I'm going to pick one of them up when I have the chance.
Yeah. And I do think this is something that, I mean,
sorry to use a violent metaphor there that I did not intend to have a violence attached to it. But politically speaking,
that was a weird apology. Violent metaphors are fine.
Don't apologize. What the hell? An astronaut? Don't apologize, Churchill.
I do think this is a good point. Like, both sides feel justified here, right? Both sides are saying, like, the other guy has taken us to a new low, and I can only rescue us from the darkness by descending to his level first. Like, it's very mythical. I genuinely believe that both of these idiots are, like, have this moral calculus where, like, you know, Mitch McConnell really believes Harry Reid is worse. Harry Reid really believes Mitch McConnell is worse. And they are exactly the same. They are perfect twinsies.
There was, though, if I can say that there are a couple of, I don't know how many times the Rubicon metaphor is now like the lazy river at a water park, and we're constantly just kind of lounging around in it or crossing it multiple times every day.
You should apologize for that metaphor.
Harry Reid crossed something. Like, trust me, that's way at the end of my apology list, Peter. I've got much better things to apologize for. But Harry Reid should not have done what he did when he did it, which was to lower the threshold for ending debate on nominees, basically so that judicial nominees and other sorts of court, or rather administrative appointments, could be made without, with fewer than 60 votes. Then McConnell is the one who did that, applied that to Supreme Court justices. If they were going to be serious about it, they could have worked. I mean, like, the whole point of the Senate is to be a moderating influence, and the whole point of the filibuster, as it gets worked out, is that it forces people to have more moderate appointments. And if they don't want to do that, they should both, they can both take a bunch of blame on that. But when McConnell said that, and it was one of those things where he said it out loud, obviously every Senate majority leader believed it, but that the goal of the Republican Party, the Republican majority in minority, I guess, at the time when Obama was elected president, was to make him a one-term president. And that's actually, from a real politic point of view, and I think from a kind of public choice point of view, I think from a particular type of libertarian point of view, that's all legitimate, but it's really fucked up. And it is, like, I'm not going soft in my dotage of saying, like, what we really need are, fucking statesmen who can bring us together. But we actually do need at least a couple of people who aren't absolute scumbags, who all they fucking care about is winning the next election or winning the next vote or winning the next routine. And we have a couple of people like that. I mean, it is somebody like Justice Amash.
There's a Freudian.
Massey in his better days. Justice Amash would be great. Yeah. But I mean, we really do need more voices like that. And I say that especially, and maybe it's special pleading for libertarians, because, like, what else has been going on during all of this is that we're cracking trillion-dollar deficits again. Absolutely nothing is being done about entitlement spending. Who the fuck knows what foreign policy is going on right now? And we're dicking around over procedural stuff. It's like a bad Star Wars movie. And it's just Jar Jar Binks is completely running the Senate. Enough's enough. Let's have actual ideological discussions and policy.
But if there's one thing that nobody has tolerance for, it's somebody who appears to be a moderate. I mean, this is Collins. This is
not a moderate. No, a centrist. And actually, I think Collins rose to
an occasion. Every single person in America is pissed at her right now.
Yeah, I mean that's the temperamental center, as I tried to put it the other week. Regardless of what your ideology is, Jeff Flake's ideology is not actually moderate, but his temperament is, and that is seriously the most hated portion of American politics right now.
Do we have any reason to believe that taking the extra week, and it's clear that it didn't solve anything in the short run, but it didn't damage anything, and it seems to me that when tempers cool a little bit, it's like, okay, yeah, you know, because you can't have these things go on for, you know, decades or for years because you can never get anything done. But it seems to me that it gave a little bit more breathing space. It made it clear, like, that the Swetnick allegations were almost obviously false. There's, like, no corroborating evidence of that. The heat from the Ramirez charges kind of that cooled down and moderated a little bit. And I think it gave people a sense of, you know what, whatever happened in Georgetown Prep, it's not really clear. And it, you know, it doesn't seem like we're worse off as a nation because we took an extra week. And maybe over time, people will be like, okay, this was vetted more than we thought.
I think it was a better idea to wait this week than to not. And to have voted immediately, I think that Flake was right to call for this. I'm not sure it did that much good, but if the choice was voting immediately after the hearing or waiting a week and having the FBI interview 10 more people, waiting a week and having the FBI interview 10 more people, just if we're looking at it as a binary choice, that was the right one.
A typical thing to do in these moments of overheated complete, you know, partisan mutual assured destruction is to imagine that there is, or root for there being, certainly a different lane people can be in. I certainly don't recognize myself when I see everyone else talking about these things, for the most part, with a couple of exceptions out there, mostly in the writerly universe. But there's another argument, too, which is, and this seemed clear from the outset of the nomination, even before the allegations of sexual assault from back in the 80s, which is that both sides really wanted a fight. Like, they were looking forward to a fight. And when you have two sides that really want to have a fight after school by the backstop at 3 o'clock, they're going to be a fight that day. I think one of the interesting things to watch here is the sense, and this was most spelled out, I think, best in the New York Times a few days ago by Brett Stevens, who's a big anti-Trump conservative. And he's just like, you know, right now, this is exactly why I like Donald Trump, because he is fighting. And he stood up to the mob, and the mob was going crazy here, which I agree with many of, that the mob is going crazy here. But we need someone to fight. This has brought out enthusiasm. We'll see how long that lasts. Republican enthusiasm prior to the midterms, they'd had a huge gap for more than a year in all election-related matters. But this, people wanted the fight. They got a fight. Now they're happy. Now they're mobilized. So, Peter, isn't this sort of the market asserting itself? We have a market for political combat in this country, and maybe this is just the way it's going to happen. Peter,
this certainly is the way it is happening. I don't dispute that at all. I think that the market for political combat is, so one of the, let's go back. Let's talk about alcohol for a little bit. If you follow the debates about alcohol regulation, one of the big talking points from the folks who are much more restrictionist than I am, than anything, think anyone on this podcast would be, from the restrictionist side, is that the vast majority of alcohol is purchased by a very small number of people. So even though you have, you know, the 2/3 of Americans drink a couple times a month and a third or so drink like once a week, it's something like 90% of the alcohol is purchased by the top 10% of drinkers.
90% of the alcohol is purchased by Peter
Most of which then never gets drunk. I boxed all of my booze up over the weekend, and it's now inaccessible to me. And I think that there is a similar dynamic when it comes to the market for political combat, which is that a very small number of extremely engaged, let's call them extremely online, to use the phrase that the kids use now, extremely engaged, extremely online people basically treat politics as a form of kind of personal, right? Like it's where they get their identity. It's where they get their entertainment. It's where they get their meaning from their life. They think about this stuff 8, 10, 15, 24, 28 hours a day if they possibly can, right? They've got like multiple monitors on in their brain that they're thinking on and thinking about politics in parallel. And those are the people who really want to see the fight. And then additionally, you had some weird incentives here politically, which was that both Democrats and Republicans thought that a fight would be good for them. And it actually looks like both Democrats and Republicans might have been right, because coming out of the Kavanaugh fight, what it looks like going into the midterms is that the Senate races that were up in the air are now leaning towards Republicans. And so Mitch McConnell said, I believe to the New York Times, but gave a quote that's been going around, "This has energized our base like nothing we've been able to do before," ended up being a big political help to us. Mitch McConnell, who's one of his main goals is, of course, to maintain Republican control of the Senate, and it looks like he might even expand the margin. On the other hand, it now increasingly looks as if Democrats are going to take the House, and in part that's because of the Kavanaugh fight and how energized folks are on the left and the way those races are end up looking. So there's not just a market in terms of the people who watch politics. There's also a market in terms of the people who work in politics, the politicians whose job is to orchestrate this stuff. Both sides kind of saw that there might be an advantage and wanted to play this pretty maximally. And they did.
Catherine, when you hear a stadium or an arena filled full of people just cheer their lungs out at a Supreme Court confirmation announcement, what does that make your dark anarchist heart?
It makes me throw up in my mouth a little bit. Like, it's really not great. That's not where we should be.
Okay,
the only thing that gets me worse is when people like bring their children out to protest something and they like make their like adorable child hold a sign and that says like, you know, Judge Kavanaugh's not my judge. And you're like, that's a 5-year-old. By the way, the new form of that is on Twitter when people like report like precocious, adorable things their 5-year-old said about politics. And you just know that there's no way that conversation really happened. It's not good. It is, however, a result of a thing that kind of smarty pantses have been saying for a while, which is, you know, the main reason to vote for one guy or the other guy is because the Supreme Court nominations are so important. You know, Supreme Court judgeships are for life. People have set this up as the highest stakes thing in American politics. And so cheering crowds respond by treating it like a really high stakes thing. It's the Super Bowl now.
And the stakes here were unusually high, or at least perceived to be, because this wasn't just any seat on the court.
Right.
This was Kennedy's seat, and Kennedy has been the most consistent swing vote in his term. And so this was replacing the swing vote, creating by any expectation, I guess I should say, the most conservative court in several generations.
At the same time, though, people, you know, David Brooks's column this week said that the headline of the column was a complete national disgrace. And 69% of Americans told pollsters that the hearings were a national disgrace. Right. Nice. And that's the other side of this is people not only like it when their team wins, they enjoy being disgusted by the other team.
I think, you know, one of the things that's going on here, too, which is adjacent to this, but were part of the problem in that, you know, and this is what Morris Fiorina, the political scientist at Stanford and the Hoover Institution, talks about, is that political people, people who care about politics, and media people are atypical. So that even if the screeching and the howling is getting more and more, and whoever the pollsters can call to actually stay on the phone long enough to give their opinion of something, we're all atypical. We're much more activated. We're much more extreme in our views and much more ideological. And one of the things that is kind of fascinating about the midterms, you know, we've now been told by every celebrity to get out there and vote finally. You know, this time it means something. The Democratic, the generic Democratic advantage in congressional and Senate races has been kind of getting softer and softer. It's no longer looking like it's going to be a wave election. And then when you look at other things,
wait,
like,
but Taylor Swift weighed in, so
exactly. You know, it's a very good test case to see Marsha Blackburn, who is running, the Republican running for Senate, who was called out by name by Taylor Swift as a terrible person, and who is one of the dumbest people, you know, to be able to grab a mic in public life. I'd put a lock on her winning. She's up like 7 points. Nothing's going to change that. Taylor Swift isn't going to do it. When you look at trust, and this is like disturbing to me, trust in the legislative branch has gone up to a like 8-year high. It's up to 40%. Republicans are feeling better about their party than they did 3 or 4 years ago and right after Trump. And things like that. And there are indications that like the soft middle of the country is actually kind of, you know, they're just not paying attention. We've talked about this in the past. Fewer people identify or affiliate as Republican or Democrat. And I think, you know, we're in to call it a bubble isn't quite capturing what it is. But like a lot of the fury that we are seeing all around us just doesn't really matter that much to the vast plurality.
But isn't it also true, or doesn't it at least feel like it's true, that the only a smallish group of people are really intensely involved and engaged with politics? On the other hand, that intensity has become more intense amongst those people and perhaps reached out to touch
that
more
I
people.
Agree with. But I think that alienates more. You see, I actually think it cauterizes like the masses of people from being like, I don't know what the fuck is their problem, but like I don't have time for that. You know, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think there's no question, you know, that the quarter of people who are hardcore Republican and hardcore Democrat, who even a few years ago, that was a third on each side, there are fewer of them. They are harder and harder core, and they are alienating more and more people because it's like you don't want to hang out with a bunch of crazy people. And to be honest, like traditional liberals and conservatives and Republicans and Democrats, they are talking as if we're on, you know, we are in the fucking rapture or something. And for most people, that isn't the case at all. You know, the country's been getting a little bit better, a little bit over time. And, you know, we haven't had a terrorist attack. Wages are going up a little bit. It's easier to get a job. Housing, unfortunately, is back to where it was in terms of people having stupid mortgages they can't afford. But I think this is a predictable outcome. And it was predicted in Matt Welch's book, which I helped him write. But it's like that, the Declaration of Independence says that the dead enders in both party are going to get more and more screaming and leer-like and beating their chests. And, you know, and most of us, you know, are just going to get on with our lives because that's that.
In theory, though, this
is
where celebrities come in, right? I mean, it may be all those things that you said may be true, but if people are generally not paying attention to politics, but they are following Taylor Swift on Instagram, and for the first time, Taylor Swift in their Instagram says, like, hey, you really got to vote. There was a longstanding theory held by many people with lots of money and involvement in politics that makes a difference, right? That's why you see all these stupid celebrities trotted out and why the Republicans are always trotting out, like, whoever they can find, which
the
is
Duck
like
Dynasty
always, like,
guys.
D minus
Stacey Dash
celebrity.
Stacey Dash is
right,
the
but, like,
secret
Republicans
architect
wouldn't do
of
that
Trump's
if people didn't believe that the celebrities are the way to energize the machine.
Republicans,
right? And so
I agree with this, but where's the proof then? Because, like, you know, Democrats have been throwing great celebrity, you know, at candidates who fucking, you know, go nowhere, and Republicans occasionally do it. Did it help? Did Mitt Romney, the only reason he did as well as he did, because Clint Eastwood talked to an empty chair? I think we need to recognize
Kid
that
Rock
people
may actually have detracted from Romney's vote share. I would say the evidence is currently in our White House. We elected
And people are joking now, right? People are like, oh, it's going to be Kanye Swift 2020. But you know what? That's the logical consequence of the line
we're on. I shouldn't
say
apolitical, but somebody with no political background or minimal political background aside from some sort of
And this is, by the way, this is how student council elections play out, right? Like, sometimes in the student council election in schools, you get the guy, the nerd kid with the policy platform, and he gets up there and he's like, you know, I think we can really get a few more extra minutes of recess if we all get together and lobby. But most of the time, the kid that wins is the one that goes, free pizza, and then throws a water balloon. And that's where we are now.
But you're crossing. Yeah, but I agree with that. But that's crossing. That's a different thing to say that celebrity
endorsements matter. Well, another way to win school elections is to have
the cool kids vote for you
and wear your little button. I mean, I really do think that that's.
I wish we were international discussion about free pizza.
Trump, after he won the nomination, the highest wattage star that Trump could get to show up in Cleveland was Scott Baio. You know, I mean, it's like, so he wasn't getting celebrity endorsements.
Republicans have bad celebrities, and Republicans still won doesn't actually refute the point. People are using celebrities strategically in our current electoral environment.
Put it this way. If I think after her last couple of movies and various statements, people will vote for then the party, whichever party guarantees they'll arrest Amy Schumer more, is going to get more votes for more people.
I just want to point out that I think that I'm the only person here to actually win a student body election for president at a large school, I might add, Lakewood High School in California. 3,000 students went to the polls.
And they said they spoke with one voice in favor of Matt Welsh.
Yes, I won't bore everyone with a story, but I was like an unpopular kid who won the presidency based entirely on ridiculous humor.
See, you're the Donald Trump of your school, Matt.
I was the Donald Trump of my school.
This is why you're so pro-voting, because you're the only one of us who has benefited from it in any way. Like all the politicians and presidents are always, of course, we talk about this sometimes. Well, of course, they're like, you should get out and vote. That's the most important thing you could do. Matt Welch, you're basically the same.
I even achieved a libertarian victory, but then it was rewritten. I had a ban on building a fence around the school, at least without student approval.
Classic libertarian victory.
Jerked me over.
Then the people with actual power changed the rules.
I'm just bummed that Taylor Swift caved, because for a long time she was the go-to celebrity refusenik just to not talk about politics. I think we need some places in the culture where people just insist on saying, I'm not going to get involved in your stupid skirmishes. Before we wrap up out of the Kavanaugh conversation. Anyone want to get in? Maybe Peter, I'll throw it to you on what this kind of preliminarily can tell us about 2020 presidential election, particularly in the behavior of putative candidates throughout this process.
I don't think it tells us a huge amount, except that Democrats are more likely to place the court front and center of their presidential campaigns. That could include anything from court packing to just talking about the need to win the presidency in order to place Supreme Court justices, as Republicans have been doing for years, to things like calling for the impeachment of Brett Kavanaugh. And already we've seen Avenatti basically say that he believes that the court should be packed and Kavanaugh should be impeached. He's not exactly a, you know, sort of conventional Democratic candidate, but Cory Booker is explicitly declining to take impeachment off the table. Kamala Harris is saying, well, let's talk about that later. Those folks are senators in the Democratic Party who are not poo-pooing that idea, not saying that it's not worth considering. And I think that sort of thing is going to be more front and center on the left in the Democratic Party going into 2020 than it has been in the past.
All right. One of the things that the nation has not been paying attention to while we've all been involved in this fight are some of the individual and also group details of President Trump's and his administration's very different, I would say, immigration policies than some of his predecessors. Nick, you wrote about one of these pieces, one of these stories last week in an individual case. Give us a briefing of the kind of the outrage of zero tolerance that you wrote about.
Well, that was a case of a an American family who adopted a Korean girl who is the niece of the wife in the couple. And they first adopted her, and then they were putting her on her path to citizenship. And the way the timing worked out, the father was serving in Afghanistan. He had a long military career from which he's now retired, but he was over there, and they missed the deadline to start naturalization. Process, which has you have to start before you're 16 for this particular type of situation. And recently a court ruled that that's tough luck. And if it doesn't get appealed or overturned on appeal, she'll be denied citizenship and will be deported from the country in about a year when she finishes school. And the family has said that they'll leave with her. And it's a good like individual case of whatever you think about immigration policy and whatever you think about the rule of law and following procedure and all of that. Clearly, you know, there's, you know, some the parents should have been more on top of things on some level or anything. But if this is what we're coming down to, where we're forcing somebody with, you know, multiple years of service in the military to take him and his family and go to Korea because there's no way to have this girl who's going to be graduating college, stay in the country legally. Our immigration policy is beyond fucked up. And I think it's one thing that is helpful in immigration. And this, of course, is, you know, these are the two rhetorical sides. One is to focus on individual cases that are heartbreaking. And then the other is to kind of paint with as broad a brush as possible that, you know, these aren't good people. They're not their country's best people. They're rapists. They're drug dealers. They're bringing disease. And it's to me, what was interesting, I got a lot of response to the story. And it was, I would say, about half and half where people were like, well, you know, if you're too fucking stupid to fill out your paperwork on time, you know, get the fuck out of the country. And then other people were like, yeah, this is, you know, if there isn't a congressman, a senator, a judge, you know, a movie star that could intercede and change this, we really are living in a terrible country.
One of the decisions that the administration made last week or the week before, within the last 10, 14 days, let's say, was to set this next fiscal year's target for refugee intake at 30,000. Which is on an annual basis would be, I think, the third lowest number of refugees taken since we've been measuring these things. The only years that went below that was 2002 and 2003, where things changed as a direct result of 9/11 and rejiggering things. And even then, it was in the high 20s and then reverted to its normal place of being in the 80 to 90,000 range. I think Obama averaged out at 75,000. And a way of thinking about this is that over the last 5 or 6 years, the worldwide population of refugees has doubled. I mean, it's gone up like 90%, something like that.
And given the United States' culpability, and I'm not saying we're the bad cause of all of this, but just our actions in the Middle East, the flow, the number and the percent increase that we have done to countries in the Middle East, it, you know, for us to be taking fewer refugees is truly disgusting.
Catherine, I know that we've talked about this before, but if you could just address briefly the refugees aren't good people, or that, you know, hey, we should 30,000, it should be zero.
Well, this is Trump's innovation in immigration rhetoric, is that he did a thing which Republicans had previously been unwilling to do, which was to erase the line or to move the line on where sort of deserving versus undeserving immigrants were divided, right? So it used to be that, sort of the typical Republican line was to say, okay, you know, there's all these people who got in line. We're a nation of immigrants. Great. That's fine. My grandfather came here legally. However, there's all these bad illegals. They're bad because they broke the law of not crossing the border. Therefore, we got to get rid of those guys, right? And that was actually, you know, that was still a polarizing debate. But what Trump has done is say, actually, there's lots of people in line or who would be willing to be in line who also shouldn't be admitted to the country. He wants to dramatically reduce the number of legal immigrants permitted into the United States. And that's a new thing. And, I think it's a step backwards in terms of kind of the moral resonance of the rhetoric, or he sort of opened back up and over the Overton window in a bad way. At the same time, though, so much of this is about perception and response. Apprehensions by the Border Patrol are down. They are lower than they have been. The number of deportations are down. Obama actually was trying to do the thing that looked like it might work as a compromise. He was trying to say, okay, we're going to be more rigorous about our enforcement. And in exchange, we're going to be able to get to a point where we have some kind of amnesty for people who are here, or at least we're going to rethink and expand our numbers for who we admit legally. We just have to get good at this enforcement thing first. Trump has just totally flipped that. He said, actually, enforcement is going to slide by many measures, except for a few showy confrontations, including this family separation stuff. And meanwhile, he's going to actively pursue reducing the number of people who come in legally. And that was not a thing that even relatively radical Republicans were willing to say before Trump.
I think Trump called the National Guard to go down to the border about 4 or 5 months ago. And to Catherine's point, George W. Bush did the same thing in 2006. I think Barack Obama did the same thing in 2013. Both of those things were explicitly, like, admittedly at the time, like, all right, you people aren't getting my comprehensive immigration reform done. So I'm going to do this to sort of like jolt you awake, to get the activist mobilized, to put pressure on you. Michael Chertoff, who was the director of Homeland Security back then, was explicit about it. I remember he came by the LA Times and I was working there and said, yeah, we're cracking down right now as a way to try to get people to the table because we really should be admitting more immigrants. Like, what? It was pretty direct. So it is a total inversion of all that. Suderman, you're from Florida. They have immigrants there. I understand. There was a lot of talk at various points in the Trump presidency here that these behaviors, particularly the separation of families at the border, which led to searing headlines and human interest stories for a couple of weeks there, would have some impact on the elections and motivate voter turnout, particularly among Latinos. I don't see that a lot in the conversation. Is that more us being in the bubble of what people are talking about now, or is maybe there not being a measurable backlash to this?
That's largely a result of the fact that the conversation has been so thoroughly dominated by Brett Kavanaugh especially for the last 2 weeks, but really for the last six. And now that Kavanaugh is confirmed, I expect that to change somewhat. Not to say that Kavanaugh won't still be item number one or two in most Democratic pitches going into the midterms, but there will be space for other things to be talked about. And I did, in fact, see people sort of throughout the Kavanaugh fight sort of say, well, you know, like, this is important, but we should also not forget the family separation issue and not sort of completely table that. Instead, it went on the back burner. I think it may come up to a front burner, at least occasionally here over the next month. Democrats in some ways have too many things that they want to talk about over the next 2 years. They're going to want to talk about Medicare for all, single payer. They're going to want to talk about immigration policy. They're going to want to talk about the Supreme Court. And they're just going to want to talk about Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Donald Trump, and how much they hate him so much because he is the absolute worst in every possible way, almost aside from any policy particulars. And so picking a message and figuring out exactly how to sort of weave all of these priorities that they have together is going to be a little bit tricky for them, I think, and is going to mean that in some ways it's going to be that something will probably get lost in the mix. Frankly, I wouldn't be totally surprised if the thing that gets to be the C-plot that gets taken off the table eventually, especially as we go into 2020, is immigration, because to some extent Democrats are parts of the Democratic Party are divided on immigration as well. I mean, the elite consensus has increasingly become more sort of open about the border, not open borders, but more open and generally. And there's a sort of a kind of a political coalition that they're building around that. But there's still parts of the Democratic Party, working class parts in particular, that are more skeptical of immigration. And so that's going to be a trickier message for them than some of the others.
Nick, you referenced Afghanistan in your immigration mm-hmm. story. We just came up on the 17th anniversary of the Afghanistan war. Pretty soon we're going to have our first death of a U.S. military service person who's born after that war began. Just talk a little bit about your culpability for this, but no, more seriously, that we aren't even talking about the Afghanistan war at this point. That Trump, who ran on being very skeptical of it, has managed to kind of do nothing and punt on it, and we continue over there. What are your thoughts on this grim 17-year anniversary?
Yeah, it's really kind of terrifying, especially if you grew up in the twilight of the Cold War and of how long Vietnam had always been America's longest war. And it's, you know, Afghanistan has lapped that a couple times. And one of the other things that's interesting that touches on something I think that both Peter and Catherine were getting at is that for the first time, according to Gallup anyway, economic issues are not what are dominating voter concerns. And the top concern for voters is it comes under the heading dissatisfaction with government/poor leadership. And the economy is not great, but it's relatively good. Things like healthcare and immigration, which people talk a lot about, they're not driving the agenda like they might have even a few years ago. And there's this vaguer sense of just like we are being governed by idiots, but we don't like any of the alternatives. So we don't turn out in large numbers, or we're not generating an alternative leadership that would actually address something like Afghanistan. I mean, because this is, you know, I'm struggling to come up with the right metaphor because it's so serious and so dangerous and so awful where we are, you know, coming up on 20 years of destroying that country, making it even worse than it was before, while pretending that we're not there, but that we're also there and that we're necessary to be there in order to preserve whatever order there is, but there isn't any order. And you can see the same thing playing out in the Middle East where I don't even know if we have entry strategies into these places anymore, much less exit strategies. And unless somebody comes along and actually raises that as an issue that motivates people, it can just kind of linger on and on. The United States is, relative to other countries, is declining as a world power. We're not admitting that, and we're not discussing what the implications of that mean for things like cutting down not just military involvement, but military bases, military spending, all of that kind of stuff. It's extremely dispiriting, specifically, I think,
I do think there's some concern for economic issues in particular for healthcare. And if you look at what Democrats, especially Democrats in tight races, going into the 2018 midterm here, have advertised all year long, the biggest single issue that they have talked about is healthcare and dissatisfaction with the health policy status quo.
Which is going to two things about that. I agree with you in the whole idea of seizing on Medicare for all, you know, good slogan, all of that kind of stuff. According to Gallup, only 5% of voters put healthcare as the top issue out of other things. And dissatisfaction with government and leadership is 29%, with the economy in general is 12%. And so it's not the same that it, for Democratic activists and, you know, for Democratic socialists, this is like all they want to talk about, because they really want single payer. They really want Medicare for all. They have a story that Obamacare sucks because it didn't go full socialist or full single payer. I don't think that many people care about
it. No, I think that's right. It's not a great national issue, but it is a pretty effective issue in local races for mobilizing Democrats who, by a large margin, care about health care, right? And so again, it's more of a midterm issue in some ways, although I think Democrats are going to try and run on it in 2020 as well.
I think what you find is that in Democratic districts, so it's something like it's an issue that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez could win on, defeating somebody like an old Democratic Party hack in a Democratic district. I think when you start to get into places where where congressional races are actually competitive, and Lord knows there's only a couple of those, then that kind of stuff goes out the window, because the immediate question is, how do you pay for it? And then the conversation changes, because people realize, okay, now what we're talking about is having more shitty government-provided health care.
Well, that's why Elizabeth Warren is making – I am not a big fan of her policy ideas, but it is pretty smart strategically what she's doing, which is running almost entirely on corporate regulation, which – at least sort of in kind of strict budget math terms, doesn't cost a dime. I'm making air quotes here. There's no
right.
Direct cost to the U.S. taxpayer up front to do a lot of that. And so she is kind of smartly trying to sidestep the spending argument that a bunch of other Democrats are walking into.
Catherine, one of the things that Donald Trump did from a political standpoint very successfully was to say to, Republican voters, hey, look, your party leaders have been paying lip service to getting tough on the border all these years, but they don't really mean it. I mean it. And to Democrat voters saying something similar, like, oh, they've been giving lip service to being anti-trade all these years and ripping up NAFTA. I really mean it. Let's table aside his actual actions on that for the moment and talk more about the politics of it. And I'm applying this now to Afghanistan and foreign policy, because Donald Trump ran on, compared to the Washington consensus, a pretty more radically anti-interventionist or intervention skeptical kind of campaign. Hasn't really done, I mean, he hasn't started a new war, so there's that. And aside from tweaking allies here and there, hasn't accomplished anything from that point of view really yet. So my long-winded question is, do you think that there's any available politics for someone to come around and say, hey, look, you know, Trump promised a more restrained foreign policy, but I'm actually going to cut and run from Afghanistan, which, by the way, is the Bill Weld position, surprisingly. Do you think that there's any available politics out there for that, given how really unpopular that particular war is?
I'm not sure I totally agree with your read on what Trump did and why it worked. I think it's true that he kind of went hardcore in some places that both of the mainstream parties had been hand-waving and filibustering a little bit. I think, though, that it was less about people wanting those policies and having been denied them by the mainstream parties, and much more about people wanting to have their sense of grievance and identity politics validated. And Trump offered that in the form of going hard on these couple of policies. I don't know exactly what identity politics are validated by pulling out of Afghanistan. So that's my hesitation. I'm not sure that the template works, because nobody's like jazzed about seeing themselves as being anti-war, except for like the five guys we drink with.
And the direct cost of Afghanistan is, I think most voters don't really feel like there's a huge kind of direct personal implication there. I'm not saying the direct cost isn't real. It's very real in terms
but
of blood and treasure.
But mostly Americans have not died a lot recently, and that makes a huge difference.
And it doesn't feel like well, this is, you know, taking 10 cents out of my tax dollars, in part because we're you can make the argument anyway, money's fungible, that we're financing it via the deficit. And so so people don't feel it in their pocketbook, and they don't see their friends and their friends' children dying in the way that I think it takes to mobilize a real anti-war.
That's how you get culture war over war. That's how you get the kind of, you know, 60s and 70s version of culture war about war. It has to do with people seeing not only a personal interest, but also their identity being tied up in being pro or anti-war. And right now, I don't think anyone's is, whereas lots of people's identities are tied up in being pro or anti-immigrant, for instance.
Speaking of Americans dying, I know that Nick, in our end of podcast, what culture products are you consuming, has been watching Americans try not to die on television. Nick, what have you been watching?
The third season of Amazon's Man in the High Castle series dropped, I guess, 2 days ago, and I've been binge watching that ever since, kind of actually trying to stretch it out because it's it takes forever for the next season to come out, but it's fantastic, and it's built around, although I think in every way superior to the Philip K. Dick novel, Man in the High Castle, which imagined the Axis powers winning World War II, and that by the early 60s, the western third of the United States was controlled by the Japanese Empire, and then much of the rest of the country, except for the Rocky Mountains, was controlled by the an extended German Reich. And the two superpowers now, the Axis superpowers, are making a move on each other. And there's time travel and kind of these meditations on whether or not we're really live or thinking or being dreamed by other people. This actually, I think, is one of the reasons the show is so resonant right now, is that people are constantly thinking of alternative outcomes and parallel universes and the ways in which you can get to a place where more things are better. And it's very powerful, and it's just incredibly well made and on every level. So that's what I'm spending my time with.
Peter?
I watched the Netflix original film Hold the Dark. It is the third movie directed by Jeremy Saulnier, who grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. His first film was not exactly self-financed, but a super low-budget kind of Coen Brothers-esque revenge movie called Blue Ruin that's really great. And then his second film was an even better follow-up titled Green Room, about a bunch of punk rockers stuck in basically a Nazi punk rock bar in a kind of siege environment, with the lead Nazi being played by Patrick Stewart. It's such a great movie. So Hold the Dark is his new film. It dropped 2 weekends ago on Netflix. Among other things, sort of shows what Netflix is doing in the feature film space and how we're getting kind of really some interesting stuff. Although I think it's probably his weakest film. But it's about a guy who is a somewhat older writer about wolf behaviors, who wrote about killing a wolf that had killed, I believe, a child. He's summoned to a town in Alaska, and then things turn very, very weird, and it turns into a sort of moody, psychological horror thriller with a serial killer element, in which the wolves are really sort of metaphorical. Anyway, I think it's about contemporary America is what I'm saying.
I am.
But mostly it's about relationships.
Speaking of relationships, I am in honor of the baseball playoffs happening right now, I have begun to read a new book by Rob Nyer, who's kind of the heir, intellectual heir of Bill James, the great baseball writer and analyst. I worked for him for a long time. He's written a bunch of books. They've co-written a few as well. But he's got a new one out called Powerball: Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. And it takes the great literary device of choosing some rando game on September 8th, 2017, between the Oakland A's and the Houston Astros, unpacking that entire day, interviewing 1,000 different people about it, but also as a snapshot of where the game has proceeded from a managerial point of view, organizational point of view, since the publication of the book Moneyball by Michael Lewis, which talked about the kind of early revolutionaries of the Bill James-inspired baseball analytics and strategizing. That's right. Movement. So it's already very good. I've just cracked it open. And I also have to say, as a way of encouraging corruption, they sent it to me, this book, with a Mike Trout baseball card inside of it as a, wow, as a bookmark. So, word of the wise out there, that's how you do it. Give me that or Shohei Ohtani baseball cards is always going to get my attention. And I just teed that up before Catherine so that she can fire me while telling me what she's been
doing. I am truly scandalized by your lack of professional ethics. I, this weekend, tried all of the scooters. That's what I'm consuming. I got on all the different scooters.
Wow.
Because there's now, there are three different competing scooter companies in Washington, D.C., it feels like a triumph for capitalism, even in a space crowded by dumb, subsidized public alternatives, including our constantly, burning metro system and these bike shares that everybody loves so much. The scooters are a total delight, friends. It was my anniversary this weekend.
Oh.
My husband and I scooted down to the mall to go see some art. It was the best. I have some views about the different brands, but right now I would say I think Lime is the best. There you go.
Do you wear a comically bad helmet?
I did not wear a helmet. I feel like the scooter falls below the helmet threshold. I stayed on the bike lanes. I know myself. I am both a bad driver and a not very physically coordinated human in general. So I had been scared. But I feel like if even I can successfully ride a scooter and feel like I'm not going to die without a helmet, you can too.
I do have to say, I sometimes have recently felt joy in my heart as I'm crossing town. And I'll be in an Uber and I will see alongside the Uber, I will see three different competing scooter brands and also a private bike share rental, one of these dockless bike things. And also I'm starting to see people on these weird single wheel scooter, skateboard scooter things. And now I don't think they're rentable, but they're a giant single wheel and then you stand your feet on the outside of it. And so it's like, here's all the different modes of transportation, plus people riding the bikes that they own themselves. And of course, it's facilitated by the city's bike lanes, which are really excellent. But it's really, it's great to sort of see transportation competition after, I've lived here for 13 years now, and it's basically always been a little bit of bikes, a lot of walking, and a lot of cars. And we're now actually seeing multimodal opportunities crop up in a way that I think I will actually commend Washington, D.C. for not going full bore, you cannot do this.
Which like San Francisco.
I totally, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, would Washington, D.C. let the roads get this kind of chaotic and crowded? I would have just said probably not.
Also, by the way, it's sort of fun to have the three different apps open and go around hunting for scooters.
Wow. You like price shop?
Well, holy, you don't price cow shop. It's availability, right? So there were two of us, so we needed two scooters. So we're like, okay, there's a Lime parked next to a Skip. Let's go.
Did you guys use competing brands at
we
the
did.
Same
we
time?
We were scooting on different brands.
And did you and your husband come to different opinions?
No,
about
we agree. Lime is the best.
So you always got to ride the Lime when there was...
Yeah, because I was the highest risk rider. yes, it was delightful. Scooters are full of joy. There's a note of happiness for the end of our podcast.
Is it killing the streetcar, I hope?
The streetcar killed itself. The streetcar is suicidal from the very beginning.
But isn't it, it's kind of fascinating, and not to extend this, but I think this is kind of optimistic of just... all of this mini transportation revolution happens right as cities such as D.C., which spent billions of dollars on a fucking streetcar, are going big and colossal and giant and unmovable and useless. And then suddenly you have like a mini revolution, which reminds me of the ways in which we're, you know, we're still seeing fights over net neutrality and who gets to control the last, you know, 2 inches of coaxial cable or fiber optic cable into your house, right at a time when that technology is about to be superseded by much more mobile, much more wireless stuff.
I'm just very excited for the whatever the next Pokemon Go, whether it's Pokemon Go 2 or something similar, whatever that is, when we can all go Pokemon hunt on scooters. Our scooters.
This weekend, I literally floated the theory, was Pokemon Go a way to pave the way for people to get ready to hunt for scooters? Because it's exactly the same. You watch them pop up on the map and you kind of go after them.
Well, and so is the collection mechanism. So they pay this basically miniature bounties for non-staffers to just go pick up scooters. And so there are apparently parts of the country, cities where this is like a prime activity for high school kids looking to make money after school, is to just like run around town picking up scooters and charging them.
And even that, Matt Welch, you'll remember from the great areas in Southern California when shopping supermarkets would pay people to bring shopping
carts. And you know what? I will shut up after this. But I just want to say, no science fiction writer would have predicted this.
This is like the internet, basically.
Right, but it is a reminder that the future is weirder and sillier and more delightful and also simpler often than we imagine, right? This isn't like we're doing this all with hot air balloon network system. We haven't put up monorails. There's no
nanotech Zeppelin.
Like, nothing like that. Instead, somebody was just like, let's let everybody pay $1 to rent
a scooter,
a little tiny motorized scooter.
Just until you see the bodies piling up, and then you'll have
Nick,
wanted
we're
that
just trying to end it on a happy note, bro.
No, I'm joking. I agree. It's fantastic, and it is the unpredictability and then the ubiquity. Those are the two things that make it hilarious, right? Because like 5 years ago, nobody was like, yeah, scooters, that's the solution. And now they're everywhere.
Too long didn't listen version of this podcast. We're all going to die in a fire. Scooters are cool. Listen to Nanotech Zeppelin. Goodbye, everyone.